Modern research in the field of hypnotism began with the researches of Anton Mesmer in the 18th century. While these researches in many ways produced positive results, they were open to criticism and suspicion, perhaps at least in part because of the rather flamboyant way in which Mesmer practiced the art and the peculiarly bombastic style in which he wrote on the subject. Even a progressive man, philosopher and scholar, Benjamin Franklin, after examining and attending some of Mesmer's seances, declined to affirm his belief in the validity of the phenomenon. Scientific bodies were particularly unhappy about the whole subject. But it must be admitted that enough doctors and scientists became interested to cause a heavy controversy, which locked the subject for nearly 75 years. It was in the middle of the 19th century that an English physician began to experiment with the theories of Mesmer and applied them cautiously but successfully to a number of cases that came under his personal care. He changed the name from mesmerism to hypnotism, and again brought down the wrath of the gods. In this case, the gods consisted not only of scientific bodies, but of religious groups and public opinion itself. It is quite probable that public opinion was rather heavily influenced by certain clergymen who thundered against hypnotism from their pulpits in the same way that they had also thundered against anesthesia. The popular mind, however, came to regard hypnotic techniques as a kind of magic. It involved all of the romantic overtones that have been preserved to us in the story of Svengali. The hypnotist was a satanic person, weird, strange, and actually a sorcerer out of the literature of the Middle Ages. His method, being poorly understood, were richly misunderstood. And the popular mind came to the conclusion that a visit to a hypnotist was very much like a pact with Satan. In some way, this system of treatment interfered with the normal function of the human soul. It was a dastardly contrivance, giving to the operator tremendous power and control over the life of every innocent Trilby that came along. This attitude was not improved by the rise in the 19th century of stage hypnotism, in which the entire field fell into the lap of entertainment. This meant every possible means of exploiting and dramatizing the subject with little regard for its dignity or its basic meaning. Gradually, however, interest in the fact revealed through the technique of hypnotism increased, and probably developed most rapidly after the rise of our interest in the psychological life of the individual. When we began to study the internal subjective functions of the human mind, it opened the door for the further estimation of the basic problem of hypnosis. First of all, there was much rubbish to be cleared away. Much of this rubbish, of course, had no more sound foundation than public opinion. But there was also a tie with antiquity that proved rather embarrassing to scientific men who do not like to be regarded as the direct descendants of witch doctors. They feel this is somewhat a compromising of their dignity. We know that hypnosis in various forms and under various names was broadly practiced among ancient peoples, particularly among primitive people. In many places, in the therapy of Greece and Rome and Egypt. But in our living experience, we found a close tie with certain Bhutan practices of the West Indies and the mysterious remedies of the American Indian medicine man. Such affinities and affiliations were not particularly intriguing to the American Medical Association. We sort of felt that it should be regarded as having outgrown such old beliefs. In time, however, private practitioners stepped into the field. They began to contemplate the matter much as Paracelsus had done, with a new dedication. Namely, a dedication to the need of the sick. But this should come before all prejudice, and we should decline or reject nothing which could be actually useful. Because of the prevailing popular prejudice, one of the earliest types of investigation in the modern field of hypnotism was to determine whether there was any truth in the idea that some mysterious fluid, essence, energy, substance, passed from the hypnotist to the subject. Was there some strange bond set up by means of which the completeness of personal integration was injured? Did the hypnotist, so to say, put some part of himself into his subject, where it remained, to affect freedom of thought, or freedom of action, or independent psychological existence? All research to the present time has indicated that this is not true, that there is no connection established between the hypnotist and his subject, other than that which is evident and obvious in the phenomena itself, that there is a temporary influence cannot be denied. But that this influence is other than psychological is now not only denied, but rather clearly disproved. Many ways can be used to check such things, and all checking has as yet proved negative. There seems to be no need for the assumption that hypnosis involves metaphysical elements. It is purely a physical matter, but one which involves elements of our physical nature, which have only been known to us within a comparatively recent period. Once the public has come to recognize that the hypnotist is a physician and not a magician, much good can be accomplished. An individual with numerous difficulties can hope for help in this direction. Now we know that religious authority is very powerful in our thinking. No one wishes to discount the importance of religious belief. There are religious groups today that are strongly opposed to all hypnotic research. They do not even wish that the subject should be explored. Certainly, their members, if they wish to be in good standing, must follow the leadership of the faith to which they belong. But as no faith or no sect dominates public opinion in this country, according to the definite provision of the First Amendment to the Constitution and the first section of the Bill of Rights, those of other beliefs not holding this antagonism towards hypnosis have a perfect right also to explore their own convictions and make such discoveries as they feel may be of common benefit. As in the case of anesthesia, the benefits are now becoming so obvious that old opinions are being forced to change. And in most instances, such changes increase public comfort and safety. Hypnosis as a field began in a comparatively simple area, namely the possibility of communicating certain attitudes, certain instructions, certain suggestions from one person to another in a manner more favorable than homely advice or old-fashioned admonition. As the time passed, however, it became evident that the whole concept of hypnosis rested upon a pattern of universal laws. That these laws not only invited, warned you, but opened a broad field of research, a field capable of making a variety of contributions at different times and under different circumstances. Thus, the concept, the basic hypothesis, underlying the fact of hypnosis, gives us many inducements to explore neglected areas of mental phenomena. There is even a suggestion, a hope, that out of the byproduct of hypnotic research, there may come an entirely new concept of therapy, a concept that which will not involve hypnosis as we know it today, or at least only in small parts, but which will drive home to us one of the most important truths in the entire world of therapy, namely the possibility that man can become his own physician, that the individual possesses means for restoring health on many levels by the use of energies resting within himself, rather than by the use of comparatively violent medications and drugs. So if hypnosis leads us into a field of drugless therapy, we may do the body a great favor. For under our present system, we must first use the drug to get over the malady, and then we must use every resource of the body and mind to get over the drug. Consequently, we fight death with a kind of death. And we are not always sure which kind is going to win. In this case also, we come to certain truths or principles which we must explore. And as is so often the case in all fields, and this is not unique to our present subject, the primary facts, the essential principles, are as yet elusive. We have only secondary facts. We have only observed or recorded knowledge. But the very core of the subject, the very nature of the hypnotic influence itself, though approximated, cannot be fully defined. We know that the principal problem is to discover, if possible, how the human system reacts to suggestions and to what degree it can react, and in what department of structure or function the effect of hypnosis can be seen or noticed. What is the hypnotic state as we understand it today? Some have said that it is an artificial somnambulism, that the individual can be put to sleep in many ways, by a narcotic, by an hypnotic drug, by hypnotic suggestion, and by just plain boredom. Up to the present time, however, we have not been able to standardize the therapy of boredom. But we have been able to observe that certain drugs will produce forms of hypnosis. This is one of the points that reminds us that it is not the result of the mental attitude of an individual. We also realize that somnambulism is a form of sleep and is usually an artificially induced, trance-like sleep condition. Somnambulism, however, is found without hypnosis. And there is a considerable structure of knowledge bearing upon natural and automatic somnambulism. Somnambulism as an artificial or induced form of sleep suggests that in some way it derives itself from the natural form of sleep. The principal factors in sleep as we know them today are fatigue and the rapid increase of toxin in the body due to the breakdown of structure under activity. The individual goes to sleep for several reasons, one of which is that he is tired. Hypnosis originally worked upon the hypothesis that the operator induced an artificial fatigue. And it was found that this fatigue could be most easily and quickly induced by fatiguing the optical structure. The individual under eye strain fatigued rapidly. Also under eye strain, particularly when this strain is scientifically induced, there came a kind of disorientation which increased fatigue and caused the person to seek its escape in sleep exhaustion. The second possibility that has been brought to our attention is that hypnosis is closely associated with the phenomenon of hysteria. We know that hysteria, as it is studied psychologically has very little in common with what we call an hysterical outburst. In the 19th century, it was proper, in fact, practically required, that ladies become hysterical under all critical situations. Since that time, however, better solutions have been discovered both for and by the ladies. Hysteria is actually almost a paralyzing experience. It causes the individual frequently to lose consciousness. Under some kind of excitement, pain, fear, particularly psychic fear and psychic pain. Hysteria was an excitement, an almost instantaneous nervous breakdown, which, because the damage was comparatively negligible, enjoyed a rapid recovery, usually in a few moments with the aid of a little ammonia or smelling salt. It is conceivable that fear, as we knew it in the 19th century, particularly fear of the unknown, which involves the hypnotic concept, caused individuals to become disoriented in the presence of hypnosis, and therefore subject to a kind of hysteria, or a blacking out of their normal conscious function. This concept had some merit, but now we go perhaps even further. We know now, for example, that sleep is not what we always thought it to be. There is more than one cause of sleep. In fact, there are more than the several causes we once recognized. We now know that a very powerful factor in sleep is habit. By placing persons in caves under the earth, where it was not possible for light to reach them, we made them servants of their own watches and clocks, which was a very interesting experience, especially if these timepieces were scientifically, shall we say, tampered with. A clock could be placed where a number of persons could see it. A clock so arranged in its mechanism that it recorded 60 minutes on the face in a period of only 30 minutes of actual time. It was found that the persons involved slept according to the clock and not according to true time. It was found, therefore, that if the clock was sufficiently slowed, the person might not feel any unusual fatigue or need of sleep for 20 or 30 hours. But if the clock was made very rapid, he might consider himself as having finished his day's work and be completely exhausted in 3 hours, even though in all the procedure, the nature of his residence, a cave under the earth, was certainly not inclined to create physical fatigue. So the fact became rather evident that the clock became an hypnotic agent. The clock told him when to go to sleep. Whiff, he was asleep. Just as surely as though he had been handed an adequate amount of chloroform. Therefore, habit also indicates how strongly we can influence ourselves. Actually, the clock, regardless of the time on the face of it, could have very little effect upon us if it did not set up within ourselves a series of association mechanisms. We fooled ourselves the meaning of the time on the clock, regardless of the truth involved. When the clock said 8 o'clock in the morning, we were hungry for breakfast, even though the true time might be 11 o'clock at night. When the clock said noon, we began to look for lunch. And because it is almost impossible for individuals to measure time adequately, experiments were made which proved that the individual could develop a healthy appetite between breakfast and lunch in 45 minutes. Also, that he could have no appetite at all between lunch and dinner, in the ordinary sense of the word, because the clock was wrong. Therefore, he was not uncomfortable if there was a 12-hour interval between meals. The clock regulated his life. It regulates most of us in one way or another. The clock, however, merely suggested something continuously, suggested traditional habits, ways of doing things. And the rest of the job we did for ourselves. If we had not been able to read the clock, we probably would have thought of relaxed and might have come into a common rhythm of our own. The pattern of our own nature might have come through. And we could return almost to an animal state in which the animal eats when it's hungry and sleeps when it's tired because it cannot read the clock. A blessed state for the animal. From this series of researches, several very important points were demonstrated. First, naturally, that we suggest habits to ourselves. We use certain subconscious patterns. We live by them. And our entire pattern of expectancy is dominated by them. Also, that these expectancies in ourselves produce a series of psychophysical reactions. Hunger is not of itself completely a psychic thing, although it may be influenced thereby. Normal hunger arises from normal needs, but it can be artificially distorted so that it can occur more rapidly or less rapidly than habit. This may be due to our old kinship with the original pre-Adamite man. Because primitive man, like the animal, probably nibbled as often as possible, eating not much at a time, but frequently. And the entire regulation of nutrition, sleep, exercise, came to man as a result of purposes of his own. Artificial situations that he himself set up. Working hours depended upon regularity. Man gradually set up rules to govern fatigue, hunger, and many other habits. These rules also ultimately became a part of his subconscious life. When, however, his conscious life is disordered in any way, the old rules, which never really changed, the rules which were before man's self-consciousness, simply assert themselves once more. Thus, man has a certain capacity to perform any function at almost any time. It is only specialization that has determined the time in terms of clock or sundial or hourglass. The next point that comes from this particular situation is to consider to what degree man has the power of suggesting to himself, and how far such suggestions can be carried for woe or weal. As suggestion is actually a more or less voluntary process, and we cannot accept or respond to a suggestion that violates the energy sources which make suggestion possible, it follows that the average person, unless he is under abnormal stress or under some psychotic pressure, will seldom, if ever, suggest to himself or vitalize the suggestions of others that are contrary to conscience and morality. He will only suggest that which is acceptable to some pattern within his own nature. Within this pattern, however, there are numerous degrees of possibility. We know that the simplest of these suggestions in hypnosis, sleeping and waking, is only a beginning. The suggestion has already been demonstrated to have a number of possible applications and specializations. We know, for example, that the individual, by suggestion, can block pain reflexes, that he is therefore able, at will, to remove sensation from areas of the body. Now this blocking becomes a very interesting thing, because it was originally assumed that this blockage originated in an area of the brain, that hypnosis produced a certain disassociation within brain areas, much as they become disassociated in natural sleep. This theory, however, must depend for its validity upon the concept that the brain is a highly complicated instrument composed of so many key areas that various small locational parts can be anesthetized without interfering with the major body of the structure. Now, for example, we do not have to anesthetize along a nerve, which would be the common concept. The belief, for example, that as we may put Novocaine into some branch of the trifacial nerve, thereby blocking one side of the face, we bring our automatic or hypnotic tension into some area of the brain and block, perhaps, the nerve reflex in the arm, or cause it to deaden or lose sense of fear. Or we may block a large area, as in the case of the use of hypnosis in obstetrics. But here is the thing that makes it all very peculiar. We can block the last joint of one finger. We can leave the other joints wide awake, the whole hand wide awake, and the whole arm wide awake. To achieve this peculiar result, and there are many ways in which we can prove this, it will probably be necessary for us to reform some of our notions as to the mechanics of the hypnotic process. In optics, for example, we can block a form, a pattern, or a color. We can take a large room with 100 persons in it, and under hypnotic suggestion, we can block the subject's ability to see one of those persons, but continue to see the other 99. The one person that he cannot see can wander all about the room, standing in front of the other 99, one at a time, and in any accidental order. The subject will continue to see the person behind the one he cannot see, but will not be able to see the person that is blocked out. The room is not blocked. The power to see is not blocked. The power to remember fully and completely every occurrence in the room is not blocked. There is no damage to memory, consciousness, awareness, or general vision. There is simply one person distinguished as a person who simply remains invisible. The same consideration comes in the problem of taste reflexes. We can cause an individual to enjoy food with all of its most delicate flavors and can completely block out the taste of onion. We can dose everything the individual is eating with onion. And we may have previously learned that onion is one thing he cannot eat or which distresses him profoundly. Yet he will eat and enjoy all flavors and swear there was no onion in the food. We can hand him the onion, and by blocking his visible sense of the onion and his taste sense, we can let him eat the onion, and he will be convinced that it is an orange, a pear, or a cucumber. Yet no other part of his mentality is interfered with. On a still more interesting psychological level, we can also cause him to project from himself as visible phenomena conditions which have no existence. To return to this 100 rooms, this 100 persons in a room, a person can be caused to be visualized in that room who is not there, can be seen as clearly and easily as any person who is there. The subject who has visualized this person who does not exist can go up to him and shake hands with him with no sense that the handshake is not with another person as solid as himself. Thus, we can also project from the individual a whole series of non-existing circumstances. The old theatrical performance of causing the person to believe that he is walking across a river, when he is only passing over the living room rug, is probably remembered by many of us. How carefully this person will remove his shoes and stockings and wade painfully across the old Persian carpet. He sees the water. He knows it is there. He feels that it is wet and cold. And yet, there isn't any. Go on into other fields of possible suggestion. And remembering always that the only way that the person can receive this suggestion or visualize it is by a kind of personal acceptance of it. We also begin to ask questions that probably will become more important 20 years from now. And that is, where does this process of self-suggestion begin and end? How much of what we believe to be here now exists only because of our own believing? What part of the universe is the projection of our own general acceptances? What effect does this acceptance have upon our culture, our concepts of value, our appreciations of art, our dedications to various pursuits, our recognition of the excellence of various subjects? To what degree are all these acceptances merely dramatized by our own intensity? Is this not merely the extension of the fact that man creates his own psychic life, and therefore can project this psychic life upon the things that are occurring around him? Is this one of the basic causes of prejudice? Is prejudice an hypnotic power by which we literally blind ourselves to facts? Is prejudice a self-deceit so real that it can make us see water on the living room rug, shake hands with people who do not exist, or try to sit down in what appears to be an empty chair in which someone else is already sitting? Where can we say that the power to suggest to ourselves begins and leaves off? Our hope in this, of, you know, not being too greatly deceived, is that we associate this suggestion with another person, that we will not respond unless another person whose authority we accept makes the suggestion. Yet we know that the same suggestion can be made with a phonograph record, that it is perfectly possible for an hypnotist on a television program to put part of the visual audience asleep. You can be 500 miles away watching your own set, and you may succumb to his suggestion. What other suggestions do we knowingly or unknowingly accept? What is the phenomenon of the dictator, of the political policy? What is advertising? These things may all be suggestion pressures, causing us to lose a large part of our own orientation. The study of suggestion may lead ultimately to a realization of how we deceive ourselves, and also really relieve us of the opinion of our friends that we are merely doing things badly because we are unpleasant people. Perhaps we are not unpleasant at all. Perhaps we believe what we are doing, and to us it is just as real as it is unreal to someone else. This, of course, can lead to quite an area of speculation. We know psychologically that there must be some valid association between the subject and the hypnotist. But this association is one of psychological acceptance. The hypnotist does not force himself upon us. We force him upon ourselves. We suspect him of ability, and conversely suspect that we cannot resist them. We also work by contrary. For in some instances, we insist that we are not susceptible. and insist that we cannot be so influenced. But in such cases, we usually protest too much. And often, this is only an effort to hide our own fear that we can be influenced. Therefore, we cannot depend too much upon the idea that only susceptible people, not ourselves, can be influenced. The pattern of being influenced by something or someone is archetypal in all of us. So we merely let the patterns have their own way. Psychologically, what is the basis of our receptivity to the peculiar suggestion of a hypnotist? Probably, as in the discussion of last week, the primary agent is acceptance. We believe this person can do this thing. We suspect, if we are there for therapeutic or character help, that we are going to be assisted. We have certain confidence in the validity of the truth. We also have certain nervousness, certain uneasiness, which of course makes us even more susceptible. We also may resist to a degree, which will cause the reaction of hysteric tension, and we will also succumb, but to slightly different methods, which also points out that there is more than one method. There are probably hundreds of methods by which various types of hypnosis can be induced. And we are not sure that these different methods all produce the same type of hypnosis. We have not yet broken this point down as adequately as will ultimately be done. If we do not resist suggestion, if we accept it, the thought has been advanced that the hypnotist begins to become a symbol of certain psychic integrations in ourselves. For instance, the hypnotist can become the parental image. He can become the symbol of any and all dominance which we have experienced during life. As the small child places great confidence in the parental wisdom until he is undeceived, the adult always wishes or desires to come under strong leadership, leadership in which he has faith and confidence. Once a rapport is established, it is quite possible that the hypnotist takes the place of the parent image. And just as surely as the parent image in man can hypnotize him continuously, so now we have a transference of the parent image from the subjective to the objective. We have the person, the operator, as parent. And we find ourselves again as child, submitting to authority. This line of thinking may ultimately lead in a number of profitable directions, because it is a key or a clue, perhaps, to the entire nature of the parent image in man, how this image can be conditioned, directed, and to a measure, if necessary, neutralized by the introduction of suggestion. Most persons today are carrying heavy psychological loads. They are in conflict inside of themselves. We now attempt to help these persons by giving them certain psychological ventilation. We try to bring them out of themselves. We try by various means to bring their problems to their own attention. Yet even with the best of intentions, we can get into trouble. We can release more in a patient than he can handle. Or we can release elements which are not relevant to an immediate situation and may even work against it. When trying to help a person to escape from domination, we may bring him into too aggressive a state of aggression. He may have listened to everyone, but under a revulsion may in turn listen to no one. This is not a desirable situation. It is merely tossing the center of consciousness from one extreme to another. Hypnosis, however, by enabling us to explore more deeply, and by enabling us to do this without the conscious interference of the patient, can often assist us to truly evaluate. This evaluation may not in the end be different from that which will be discovered by the normal means of analysis. We may come to the same conclusion, and if both methods are correct, we must come to approximately the same conclusion. But under hypnotic technique, we can come to that conclusion perhaps 10, 20, or 50 hours sooner than by the analytical method. We can immediately break through the defenses by means of which the subject or the patient is subconsciously attempting to deceive the counselor who is trying to help him. This type of secret deceit is very, very common in most fields of psychology. We have already mentioned the problem of consciousness. And this is another area which may be opened up by hypnotic research. And many new discoveries may be made concerning the nature of consciousness. Some of these discoveries going back to opinions held long ago, but in the meantime rejected because there was no adequate means to check them, and they did not fit into the gradually evolving structure of present attitudes and ideas. One of these points has to do with the location of consciousness in relationship to the body. Now, we're not going into a metaphysical discussion of this, but rather the relationship of consciousness in what might be termed the nervous field of man's physical and corporeal structure. Is consciousness actually located in an area? Is consciousness primarily located in the brain? Does it arise, as some have held, as a reaction to certain brain stimuli? Or is it the source of these very stimuli themselves? Does consciousness, as some mystics have held, reside primarily in the human heart? Or, as is now beginning to be more suspected as a result of hypnotic research, is consciousness diffused through every cell of structure? Is, therefore, consciousness a diffusion, as Buddha thought it was? Is consciousness something that, like salt and pepper, is scattered everywhere through the structure, seasoning it all, and giving it all life. His consciousness is resident with life in structure. Then what we call objective consciousness is some aggregate of conscious factors, a plexus or ganglia of nervous or conscious elements brought together to create an area of intensivity more coordinated. And thus this intensified area then in turn reacts upon the less intensified area to serve as a control mechanism. In other words, do we gather up areas of consciousness and make them directed over non-organized areas? If such is the case, how do we do it? Is this consciousness actually under the control of the mind? Is it free of the mind? Or is the mind itself merely an expression of it? We used to think that it was under the control of the mind. This we are beginning to doubt. We used to think that it originated in the mind and was identical with it. This also we are beginning to doubt. And our present tendency is to suspect that consciousness includes the mind, and that the mind is a kind of focal point set up for the distribution of consciousness through structures having organized mental, neural structure, or nature. This brings then the possibility that mind is a kind of director of consciousness on the objective side of life. That by means of mind, consciousness is distributed through the mental, emotional, physical structure. This would be more or less harmonious with the present findings in hypnosis. For hypnosis now appears to indicate that the mind governs the distribution of consciousness or energy or the life element itself, and that this mental directive can have a series of very important consequences. We know that it can